You're listening to episode 53 of the Thrive Tribe 419 podcast, The Censorship of Science, with Dr. James Lyons-Weiler. Prosper, flourish, bloom with your people, your close-knit group, your clan, straight out of area code 419, with the most cutting-edge, controversial, and enlightening information from the most knowledgeable experts in everything, mind, body, and soul. Welcome to the Thrive Tribe 419 podcast. I'm your host, Rose Hollow. Hello, Tribe. Welcome back to the podcast. I would like to thank our sponsor, Deep Roots Wellness, a holistic approach to mental health. If you'd like more information about Deep Roots Wellness, please go to matthollow.com. That's MATTHOLLO.com, or you can find Deep Roots Wellness on Facebook and Instagram. So, as we've been doing in our last few episodes, I would like to share some information about events going on in our community that have to do with holistic health and holistic mental health. Our first that I'd like to mention is a new series called First Friday's Art Therapy. And we will be making mandala journals. I will be teaching the class along with my husband, Matt Hollow. And this class is taking place at our new location at 1450 South Clinton Street, Suite B in Defiance. We are located just south of Ace Hardware, and across from the cemetery. That's how you can find us. We're a little brick office building. And this series is going to include different types of art classes mixed with different kinds of mindfulness and mental health tools that you can take home. So this class is appropriate for teens and adults, and all art supplies are provided. And the first one, again, on the 5th, April 5th, this Friday, is going to be watercolor mandalas, which we're going to attach to the front of a journal that you can take home. And we're also going to learn some basic meditation. So if you'd like to join us for that, the best way to sign up is to either go to matthollow.com, MATTHOLLO.com, and sign up there under our events. Or you can get on Facebook and find the First Friday's Art Therapy events under Deep Roots Wellness or Thrive Tribe 419 and click on the event and click the link to sign up. The charge is $30 per person. And again, this includes all supplies, learning to meditate, and you get to take home a beautiful personalized mandala journal. Next, we have an event on Saturday, April 13th, Sunny Dispositions, Food Affects Mood. The Weston A. Price Foundation Northwest Ohio Chapter is presenting a workshop on Saturday, April 13th at 10:30 a.m. at Deep Roots Wellness, which is at 1450 South Clinton Street, Suite B. The program topic is Sunny Dispositions, addressing the impact of food we eat on our moods and clarity of thinking. This session in particular will cover aspects of GAPS, which is gut and psychology syndrome, the connection between what happens in our guts and our heads. It's based on the work of Dr. Weston A. Price, a dentist who in the 1930s traveled the world asking, what do healthy primitive people untouched by the foods of commerce actually eat and how does this affect their health? There will be plenty of opportunity to ask questions and practical steps will be offered. The program will be led by Dr. Karen Like, board-certified clinical nutritionist and certified GAPS practitioner. If you have any questions, just send us a message on Facebook, on Thrive Tribe 419 or Deep Roots Wellness, and we will try to get that answered for you. This is a free event, but we do ask for free will donations to help cover our cost of offering this workshop every month and to cover the cost of our workshop leader who travels about 2 hours both ways each month to present this to us. So We hope to see you all there. It's a really great group of people, and there's a lot of discussion usually involved between everybody that comes and the leader of the group. So it's a very interactive and casual event, and we always welcome children. We have a safe place for children to hang out in the space where we meet, and toys and books and all kinds of things. So please bring your little ones with you, especially nursing infants are always welcome, and hope to see you there. Sunday, April 28th, from 11 p.m. to 5 p.m. And we're excited to be participating in the 4th Annual Angel Spirit Fair to showcase some of Deep Roots Wellness and the energy medicine techniques for mental wellness. Matt will be giving free EFT tapping demos, and I will be offering some intuitive readings with Reiki healing, and those will be for a small fee. We'll also be sharing information about what we do in our mental health counseling practice in Defiance. So come hang out with us and get nerdy on the spiritual aspect of mental health and holistic health. Other participants will be offering intuitive readings, mediumship, and various forms of spiritual communication and healing services. $5 gets you in the door, and kids are free. And this event is located in the UAW Memorial Hall, which is the small white building that is adjacent to the larger UAW building out on Baltimore Avenue or Baltimore Street in Defiance. Please mark your calendars for something extra amazing, in my opinion. It's our podcast's second annual Holistic Health Fair, which is taking place on Saturday, May 18th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Are you feeling stuck with your health? Explore some complementary and alternative ways to care for your mind, body, and spirit. Our second annual Holistic Health Fair will feature four parts: an early bird yoga class, which actually starts at 9 o'clock. So if you would like to do that, show up at our door at 9 o'clock. And then the fair opens up at 10. And that includes a vendor's area to learn about holistic health service providers in our area and to purchase handmade, locally sourced, natural products, things of that nature. And there will be a classroom featuring several local Northwest Ohio experts speaking on various topics of mind, body, spirit, wellness. And you can pop in and out of that as you desire. There's no extra charge for that. There's also this year a quiet healing arts room where providers will offer participants a chance to try a mini session of various types of healing arts and consultation services provided by experienced and professional practitioners for a fee. And those are first come, first served. So come at 10 if you would like to get a mini session of healing touch, of access bars, of massage, or of herbology. And you'll be sure to grab a space for that. So tickets are $5 per person at the door. Kids 10 and under are free. If you do plan to come for the early bird 9 o'clock yoga class, it's going to be $10. And that includes the yoga class and entrance to the fair when the yoga class is over. And then kids 10 and under for the yoga class are $5 each. So our official lineup for the day, I'm just going to read you what we have for our speakers because I think this is really, really cool. At 10:15 will be naturopathic allergy support presentation by Dr. Watts, who is a naturopathic doctor. At 11 o'clock, we have holistic spirituality, connecting mind, body, and spirit with Reverend Jim Brailer from the St. John United Church of Christ, where this fair is taking place. At noon, we have EFT Tapping for Kids mini workshop with my husband Matt Hollow from Deep Roots Wellness, and that's completely free for kids and their caregivers to pop into. And then at 12:45, we have something called Sleeping Beauty Sleep Tips and Tricks presentation by Dr. Flaghar. She is both an ER doctor and an integrative doctor. And then finally, At 1:30, we have Dr. Karen Like, who is our certified nutritionist and GAPS practitioner, presenting My Microbes Made Me Do It. And she'll be offering information about the connection between the body, food, and flora in simple terms that anyone can understand and apply for better wellness. So we really hope that you guys mark the date again, Saturday, May 18th. Starting at 10 a.m., the yoga class starts at 9 a.m. if you'd like to join us for that. And come to St. John United Church of Christ in Defiance, Ohio. It's located at 950 Webster Street. And the church is the triangular-looking building that's located on the Defiance College campus. We're very easy to find. Feel free to park in the parking lot, on the street, anywhere you wish, and enter through the fellowship doors, the fellowship hall entrance, and we'll see you there. I'm very excited to meet many of you. We've had such great interest in this event, so see you all soon. All right, now that I've filled your head with all of these dates and events to attend, I would like to get started with the good stuff. The guest of our podcast today is Dr. James Lyons Weiler, and I would like to offer you this bio on Dr. James Lyons Weiler. He's a working scientist and also a radio show host of the Unbreaking Science podcast. He is from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but I feel like he's one of those people who definitely applies to us here in Northwest Ohio and some of our concerns, and has information that's easily accessible to us. And that's why I chose him. Besides, he's just like one of those human encyclopedias that seems to have some information and knowledge on a really great, vast wealth of topics. So Dr. Lyons Weiler is a longtime veteran in the areas of genomics, proteomics, bioinformatics, and evolutionary biology. He earned a PhD in ecology, evolution, and conservation biology, and won a U.S. DOE Sloan postdoc in computational molecular biology at Pennsylvania State University under the mentorship of Drs. Webb Miller and Masatoshi Ney. He has served as faculty, senior research scientist, and scientific director in support of translational research, systems biology, sequence analysis, and the creation of novel algorithmic solutions for the analysis of complex and challenging data. He is the author of three books, Ebola, An Evolving Story, Cures versus Profits, Successes in Translational Research, and The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. His specialties include developmental disorders, including but not limited to autism and ASD, biomarker development for complex disorders, immunology, toxicology, cancer biology, leadership, collaborative science, integrative translational biomedical research, cancer receptors, phased biomarker development, microarray data analysis, proteomic data analysis, machine learning-based prediction model optimization, and information. Hey, James Lyons Weiler, welcome to the Thrive Tribe 419 podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm really excited about our conversation today because we haven't really gotten into the nuts and bolts of freedom of speech on this podcast. And obviously it's a podcast. So this is something that I care about. And I feel like it's something that our community here in Northwest Ohio also is pretty passionate about. And I believe that when it comes to vaccines, we have people who are on both sides of the fence here. We have some who believe that everyone should be vaccinated no matter what. We have others who don't vaccinate at all. And then we have some parents who are very selective about what they do. We also have medical providers who are very open to parents' opinions and questions about things. And then we have other medical providers who are more adamant about following the CDC schedule. So I'm really glad that you are here to discuss this because I really believe that without discussion and debate, we can really turn into a herd of sheep. And that's not always the safest and smartest thing to do. So thank you again for being here.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So I have a little bit of a story that I would like to share with you and with our listeners. And I haven't talked about this very much at all on the podcast, maybe just in passing. But when I was 16 years old, I was vaccine injured. And the way that it happened was that I was planning to go on a mission trip with my church, and we were going to the Yucatan, which is that little peninsula that kind of sticks up out of the top of Mexico. And it's really, it's very jungly, rainforest type weather, very hot, lots of mosquitoes, things like that. And also it's Mexico, and they always say, you know, don't drink the water. Found that out the hard way. But anyway, so, and this was in 1995, I believe. So right before our trip, about 2 weeks before, a bunch of us kids and a couple of adults went to the health department to get caught up on our vaccines. And we told them that we were going out of the country and where we were going, and they came up with a few vaccines that they thought that we should get. So we all kind of lined up and were vaccinated. I was vaccinated with, I also want to note that none of us were asked for our vaccine records before being vaccinated. None of us were told about any kind of side effects that could happen. None of us were given any kind of information about what we were receiving. They just gave us our shots, and then they told us what we got afterwards. And they gave us a little card, which I've carried with me in my wallet to this day to remind me of what I received then and when a lot of my own health problems started. So what I got was, I got the Tdap, which is tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis. I also got MMR, which is another combined vaccine. It's measles, mumps, and rubella. And this was pre-2000, so at that time they were also giving something called gamma. And I had to do a lot of research to figure out what this gamma was. And from what I can find, and it's really hard to find information, but it's a preventative chemotherapy drug, which I've learned is something that they would give to people traveling out of the country that they were worried about communicable diseases being spread by insects. That's all I've been able to learn. Do you know any more about this than I do?
I don't. I've never heard of that before, no.
Yeah, it's very difficult to find information about it. So those are some things that I received. And then the next day I was extremely ill. My throat closed up. It was difficult to breathe. I was feeling really lethargic. I felt like I had the flu. I felt anxious. I felt depressed. It was the sickest I remember ever being up until that point in my life. It was really, really bad. And I remember my mom and dad being worried about me. And I said, I think it's from the vaccines. You know, I think that's because this happened right after I got vaccinated. And I remember my dad saying, you know, no, vaccines are supposed to be safe. This can't be from the vaccines. And my mom was like, you know, this is not like you to be this sick. You know, you've been sick in your life, but you've never been this sick. But I got a little bit better. I was still a little bit sick when I went to Mexico, but I was starting to feel better. Really not feeling like myself, though. And the whole time I was there, I just was not feeling like myself. Did get Montezuma's revenge because we were staying with locals in a very remote town. So I unfortunately was exposed to all of those kind of microbes and everything, and was really sick while I was there as well, but just kept plugging away and came home, and my health was just never the same after that. And my mom, definitely noticed a change in me at that time. And also will say that I was never the same after that. So, I always believed it was a vaccine injury and told people that, and over the years, was really dismissed by people around me, saying, no, you know, these things are supposed to be safe. We should be able to trust our doctors. This can't be what happened to you. It must have been something else. It must have been just a coincidence or weird timing. But I developed a lot of chronic health issues after that. And then when I became a parent and really started researching vaccines, because my husband encouraged me to, he already had his opinions about vaccines. And I still thought, well, they're probably okay. But I started doing my research and learning about other people who had been vaccine injured, and a light bulb went off and really validated my experience and what had happened with me. And I am very convinced that I did indeed receive, have an injury or a reaction to the things that I was poked with that day in the 90s. And that it has had a detrimental effect on my health and my life going forward. So I've never said that I am anti-vaccine. I have always said, you know, let's figure out how to make these things safe, because we want to protect ourselves from the really, really bad diseases. You know, how can we do that safely? Can we develop safer vaccines? Do we need a vaccine? Is there a better way to do this? Like, let's have a conversation about this, and let's not demonize people who are saying that they've been injured, either themselves or their family members. I think that we deserve to have a voice, and we deserve to have a conversation about this. So that's something that is interesting to me. And now with the censorship that's happening on the internet, which is really our modern public forum, I'm really concerned that people like me and people who have vaccine-injured children are losing their ability to have a conversation and fight for their children and fight for themselves. After hearing you speak at the Ohio Advocates of Medical Freedom conference, I really was impressed to see that you are taking a position kind of on the front lines of this. So I would really like to hear about what has happened since the end of February when all this censorship happened. And what are you doing right now?
All right, well, thank you. I'm sorry for the injuries that you sustained, and congratulate you on, you know, your activism and awareness. As a scientist, you know, people try to say, okay, well, you know, this is James Lyons-Weiler is anti-vaccine, and nothing could be farther from the truth. James Lyons-Weiler is simply a scientist who decided to remain a scientist in the face of the realities that I found when I began to research vaccines. This topic, like any other topic, deserves a 360-degree, you know, evaluation of the benefits, the efficacy, the safety, the cost, benefit analysis. Any other topic, is all those considerations are fair game for discussion. But the censorship began with me, actually, with my very first article. I was banned from the Daily Kos, which is a liberal publication outlet. My first evaluation of the economic and political outlay of and the influence of vaccine manufacturers. And that happened, I think, almost 3 years ago now. So, and I and others have been banned from other outlets like Medium for just writing, you know, articles. And my article that got me banned from Medium, I simply pointed out that the mumps virus that's in the mumps vaccine is an old strain that is no longer circulating. And I made a comparison of the aging of the mumps virus to the aging of the person, Gerald Lynn, who the strain was isolated from. I mean, she has, you put a picture of her as a child and an adult, you know, a woman now. She's got to be over 60 now. And you realize that a long period of time has passed since the mumps virus was isolated, and there must be mutations that have accumulated. She has changed. There's no doubt at all that the vaccine type strain of mumps has changed, and the wild type has changed. And so they decided to ban me from publishing there. Now, what's happening more recently is, you know, the vaccine risk aware community is truly gaining its legs in terms of a solid foundation upon which, you know, there are certain facts that are well established. As a community, more and more people in the community are becoming increasingly aware of specific scientific studies that the CDC wished didn't exist but are still published, and they're becoming aware of that there's a systematic troop of people who go around trying to get any article that's published in Science that finds something wrong with vaccines retracted with what I call a microscopic analysis and then a critique. And, you know, they write to the journals and they insist that this paper is so flawed it must be retracted. And this is a way to induce bias into, enforce bias really into the publication record, the scientific publication record. More and more people in the movement are speaking out and making accurate statements and citations. And there is what's happening is there's a collision of vaccine risk awareness. It happened to be happening in social media right now. And you'll see why I'm saying it happens to be happening in social media right now in a moment. That collision of vaccine risk awareness with the vaccine injury and vaccine risk denialist agenda of the CDC and the vaccine manufacturers. It's been known for a number of years that the CDC has been teaching pediatricians and teaching public health officials that general awareness of vaccine injury and vaccine risk is bad for vaccine uptake. And they say in the name of public health, that they train each other. They should, the FDA as well. They should minimize the public's perception of vaccine risk and injury. And that's of course, the complement of, you know, maximizing the public's confidence in vaccine injury. So from their perspective, they're trying to make sure that enough people get vaccinated in their mind that they have sufficient coverage. And so they feel that they are allowed to, and that it is appropriate, and that it's important to mislead the public on the nature of vaccine risk and injury. As a scientist, I can see that in the face of the reality that vaccine risk and injury occurs and then induces permanent injury and harm into the population, mathematically, what they've set up with this agenda where the vaccines are liability-free, there's no required safety testing for the components, like a dosage escalation. Animal studies aren't done on aluminum and mercury, and the actual vaccines themselves are treated differently in terms of the type of safety studies that are done. They don't use randomized clinical trials with a valid placebo, an inert placebo that doesn't have any biological effect on the body. Instead, they use either aluminum hydroxide adjuvant or they use another vaccine. And the ICANN network has done a fantastic job putting together the history. There's a great diagram that shows the history of kind of the tree of comparisons that are used. There's only one vaccine on the entire pediatric schedule that's been actually tested in a randomized clinical trial against a valid placebo. So what they've done is they set up a recipe for disaster where permanent disability and permanent harm and families who have lost loved ones to death, families who have individuals who have neurological damage, developmental neurodevelopment issues, and damage to their immune systems and form of autoimmunity accumulate in the population. And they want to call the people who do, you know, represent that segment of, you know, the population that is injured by their product. Instead of saying, well, okay, we're getting information from the post-market surveillance safety studies that we're conducting, and this information is valuable because it will allow us to improve our product, improve vaccine safety, the vaccine injury and vaccine risk denialist agenda tells them to look at mothers in the face and say, this is not happening, and gaslighting happens, and this is you can't blame the vaccine, and they stretch logic and they torture logic to the point where vaccines are just this miracle, you know, entity that has a perfect safety record, in spite of, as you well know, the cost of the payouts for the vast minority of vaccine injuries that are actually compensated have already led to $4 billion in settlements and payouts through the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Now, I want to say I should reveal a potential conflict of interest. I am an expert in the NVICP, an expert witness, and I have been an expert on, I think, 4 cases now. You know, as I said earlier, what I did when I came into the vaccine science area, I have a massive background in many areas of biological and biomedical research. I'm an expert in population biology, population genetics. I'm an expert in, you know, genomics, genetics, bioinformatics, you know, and study design. I mean, it's really uncanny how then walking into vaccine science and I saw everything here was backwards. They use correlation studies to test causation, that it's not a real test, and so on. So there's real problems. There's absolutely a valid area for debate and discussion.
Yeah.
And in the past couple of months, we've seen increased pressure on social media and internet companies like Google, Facebook, and Amazon, you know, to address what they want to call anti-vaccine claims, what they want to call, you know, misinformation. And California Representative Adam Schiff, for instance, on March 1st, sent a letter to Jeff Bezos from Amazon, the chief executive there. And Jeff is also the owner of The Post. And he said that, you know, you're spreading misinformation, you know, surfacing and recommending products and content that discourage parents from vaccinating their children, a direct threat to public health, and reversing progress in tackling vaccine-preventable diseases. And, you know, this is Schiff's position. He's not a scientist. He's not a medical doctor. And then he, you know, reported that week he wrote to Facebook and Google, expressed his concerns that their sites were steering users to bad information that discourages vaccinations, undermining public health. And then he, as proof on Twitter, he posted an image that where he started typing in the word vaccine, and he showed the actual suggested solutions or the continuation of the autofill. Apparently to him, a vaccine education, vaccine information is horrifying. People are talking about it. And then he reported that he's received official responses from Google, and he said, that the companies will be taking steps to combat what they call anti-vaccine information. And then Schiff says the ultimate test will be if these measures reduce the spread of anti-vaccine content on their platforms to the benefit of public health.
Isn't it already reduced, though? I mean, if you do a Google search, you're not seeing a lot of real anti-vax information or even questioning information. It's mostly all pro-vaccine already, right?
Well, I mean, look at I wouldn't even call it anti-vax information. It's vaccine risk awareness. It's information about vaccines. Why is discussion about vaccine risk anti-vax? There are plenty of people who discuss vaccine risk. And the irony here, okay, so if he wants the ultimate test of these measures to be the reduction of what he's calling anti-vaccine content on the platform to the benefit of public health, then he's actually overtly, specifically calling for some measure of the effect of his call for this type of censorship on public health. And if he takes vaccine uptake as the measure of public health, then he, you know, still under the control of the vaccine injury denialist agenda. So he's gotten responses from Google and Facebook that they're taking steps. And there's a bioethics professor from the University of Notre Dame who says that this is clearly, his name's Joe Holt. He says that there's a problem here because the business are being forced to play a censorship role. And they never intended to do that, but more importantly, government coerced censorship is not allowed under the United States Constitution or the laws of our land, and that's where we get into the legal area. And so, what I wanted to recast this for your listeners and other people that are interested. That there is a long history of censorship associated with media technology, right? So we can look, the views on censorship span from, it's a benevolent task that's done in the best interest of the public. That's the view of the Soviet Union. That's the view of the former Soviet Union. That's the view of China. And now increasingly it's the view of the United States, that the great unwashed masses are so ignorant in spite of this, you know, public education that we pay thousands, millions and billions of dollars for with our taxes. You know, in spite of the public education that our children have, as they grow up as adults, they're still idiots and they can't tell, you know, the difference between a seizure that happened after a vaccine and a seizure that happened, you know, unrelated to a vaccine.
Right.
That's the view on censorship is that it's a benevolent task for the best interest of the public versus the viewpoint that it's an infringement on basic human rights. And this goes all the way back to 1448 with the Gutenberg printing press. Okay. The original printing press, before people could print, if you had a book and you had to copy it over, it was copied over by scribes. And it took a lot of time, but more importantly, it was very cost ineffective to copy a book. And the Gutenberg printing press was a revolution to the point where, you know, an alternative version of the Bible could be printed. That Bible went against the teachings of the church at the time. It was considered heretical, and yet many, many, many copies could be made quickly and spread around. And then, of course, people could make flyers and just spread flyers around. But it goes much farther back, much farther back. People will remember that in 399 BC, the philosopher Socrates was forced to self-censor by drinking hemlock because the things that he was saying were unacceptable to the common view, the commonly accepted view at the time. In 1599, Pope Paul IV published a list of prohibited books that went against the teachings of the church. And Joan of Arc, who was, you know, set ablaze to her death in 1431, was silenced and censored. Galileo was silenced and censored in 1633. For talking about the heliocentric view of the universe known at the time of the suns and the planets. So people don't know this, but in 1683, the entire library at the University of Oxford was burned. That's where book burning really, really became. And so, you know, since then we've had an enlightenment. This whole thing is about, the whole area of enlightenment was about, wait a minute, we can talk, we can speak. It's okay to have different views and compare them and contrast them and let in the marketplace of ideas, have competing ideas work their way through. And Sweden took a lead in 1766 to abolish censorship. In 1770, shortly thereafter, Denmark and Norway followed. This first amendment to the Constitution in 1787 was part of the Enlightenment. And then the National Assembly of France in 1789 said the free communication of thought and opinion is one of the most precious rights of man. Every citizen may therefore speak, write, and print freely. Well, what happened between the late 1700s and, Nazi Germany, where burning books that went against the teachings of the Nazi Party was a totalitarian regime took power, and in order to consolidate their power and to silence critics, they not only had to kill people, but they had to destroy material. So they had to, they shut down the sale of anything out of Jewish shops that included information and books and pamphlets, and shut down any spreading of information from pamphlets or books by actually piling them up and burning them. So in the United States, then, you know, we do have some speech that's not allowed. We have libel and slander. You can't, you know, write or say anything that's not true about somebody that hurts their reputation. Obscenity, there are laws against obscenity. There's laws against, you know, child pornography. And believe it or not, this is kind of amazing that six states still have laws on the book against blasphemy against the church: Massachusetts, Michigan, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Wyoming, and Pennsylvania. The government feels and that it's given itself the right to censor any speech that they call an issue of national security. And then, of course, in general, we have library inclusion exclusions, like Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and that was being censored in libraries as late as 1984. More recently, there's this discussion that we should censor and limit hate speech. But the problem here, and this is not a problem, this is not my position. There's a lawyer, I'm working with about 12 lawyers now. There's a lawyer that looked at this and said, well, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist, and what you call hate speech today, you know, could actually be, you know, speech that's necessary to secure our rights. It just, hate speech is a label. So, yeah. Of course, it doesn't think that people should be able to, you know, harm other people. And there's an actual gray area in our law. And this is where the wedge is, that they think that they're insinuating this censorship about vaccines. If I can say anything I want, I can say that I think that somebody should perform act X, or somebody should not perform act Y. And I'm safe in saying that under the freedom of speech, but the minute that somebody takes me up on my statement that I should do that, or that they should do that, and it leads to harm, then I'm opening myself up to civil litigation and potential criminal, depending on what I'm calling for. You can't call for harm to any elected official, for instance. You'll get a knock on the door from,
right,
you know, from the, right, Secret Service and so on. And this is all speech that's regulated. And most people have that under control with self-censorship because they don't want the consequences of that. But now we're getting to the point where we have corporations that are running agencies, federal agencies. Where does Amazon and Google and Facebook get their information about what's valid vaccine information? They get it from the CDC. Where does CDC get their funding? They get it from the pharmaceutical companies. There's over 200 corporations that make donations to the CDC Foundation. And the CDC itself is a for-profit agency in the United States. And right. So there's this pressure to censor speech about vaccines because they have a great deal to lose. Now, I'm not going to go through the entire history of, you know, Elvis, you know, shaking of his hips and the government coming in, but there is a history there with Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction and so on. There are other controversies. It's already been tried out in the cases, like in Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction. She was initially fined $550,000. She was fined, or the television station, I forget which one, but that fine was actually shot down by the Supreme Court of the United States in 2012, where that was a freedom of expression. That was art. That was clearly art. They're communicating music, and whether you agree or disagree that the nipple and the areola on the human, you know, female breast should not be broadcast on television, and it might harm children in some way to see a human, you know, that part of the body. You know, whether you agree or disagree, it was definitely done as a form of art. And so, you know, we're looking at this from the perspective of, yes, it involves social media. Yes, it involves vaccines. But this is simply a case of government-coerced censorship. And when we cast it in that, in those terms, in the broader possible terms, this discussion is not going to be won or lost on the merits or demerits of vaccines. That's not the battleground on which this is going to be fought. I mean, the CDC put out a call for public comments 2 years ago. They had a plan to weaken the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine warnings in the vaccine information sheets. And they put out a call in December 2016, the public comments were due, on what the public thought about their plan to weaken the warnings about the MMR. Now, I have a particular opinion. Bernadette Pager and I had a very similar opinion, so we decided to combine our statements. Other people had their opinions. There were people that were for weakening. There were people that were against weakening. When we submitted our CDC public, submitted to the CDC our public comments, our comments were not being published. We saw that hundreds and hundreds of other people's comments were being published, but we didn't see ours. And finally, ours came back with actual black line redaction, actual censorship. They didn't they didn't just not publish the whole thing. They actually decided this part you can say, this part you can't say. This was clearly a public forum. And 75 other American citizens had comments that had not yet been published. So we got a hold of Jim Moody, a lawyer that we sometimes work with, and we said, okay, Jim, we'd like to communicate to the CDC that we have the First Amendment in the United States, and you invited public comments and so on. And our comments were unredacted, and 75 other American citizens' comments were then published by the CDC within 3 days' time of receiving our letter.
Oh.
Now, we successfully uncensored ourselves
with the help of a lawyer, unfortunately.
Oh, no, it was the easiest thing I did. I mean, we did. I wrote the letter. A lawyer friend of mine put my comments verbatim on his letterhead, signed it, and sent it in. It was not a big deal.
Okay.
So it was easy. It took me 15 minutes. So we need to talk about not just government coerced censorship where Facebook is telling you, you can't publish this because it violates community standards, or you can't say this because CDC told us that you can't say this. There are other social sanctions that are happening. Mitch Michaels, a reporter from Massachusetts, was hired by the WGBH, which was public radio in Boston. And this was, again, two years ago now. And Mitch Michaels was hired, but then somebody at the company found that, I think it was some online video of her talking in a public forum about her concerns over vaccine safety. And she was being hired as a scientific correspondent, and they unhired her. They actually did massive damage to her career. And I've talked with her about, you know, her disposition on this. And she lives in a small town in Massachusetts, and her statement is she doesn't want to get involved. She just wants to raise her children. And that's a shame because she's a brilliant mind, and her mouth has been silenced to speak anything about science for a long time. And, you know, of course, Vax streaming ended on Amazon, and, you know, the web forums that are currently censoring are Pinterest, Twitter, Google, and Facebook.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's also the example of a Canadian teacher who spoke out about how he hoped that the nurse that was vaccinating children in school was giving them the children full consent. And he was given a sanction. It was led to a suspension. This is a teacher at school. Yeah. And he was told that his actions brought unnecessary publicity and attention to the matter when he went to the media. And that he went to the media with this, and that his actions brought unwanted media attention instead of the sanctions against him being the cause of the unwanted media attention. That is a sign of institutionalized narcissism. And, you know, he was threatened. He said, please note that future incidents of this nature may lead to further discipline up to and including dismissal. All he was doing was standing up for the children's rights to be fully informed on the risk of vaccines.
Can you even fully inform a child? I mean, that seems like a gray area to me too. I homeschool my child, but it scares me to think of sending her somewhere where they're doing vaccines and they're like, okay, Clara, like even with the full informed consent, she would not understand that. She's just
right.
A kid.
No, exactly. Exactly. No, you're right about that. So there's some ironic points that I'd like to bring up. For instance, recently there was a USA Freedoms Act that gave Google and other corporations the right to disclose details to which, you know, U.S. agencies had access their customer user information about national security issues. And so the corporations are being granted rights to freedom of speech, while at the same time, the same corporations are being asked to censor. And so what I think people should do is don't think about this as that anti-vaccine versus pro-vaccine and the government's on the side of pro-vaccine and the people are on the side of anti-vaccine. This is simply targeted coerced censorship. And the lesson here is the same age-old lesson. The same people that are calling for censorship of this right now, many of them belong to a particular political party. And if a demagogue were to take power, they were to take the House, the Senate, and the White House, what's to stop that party now from saying, Facebook, we don't want anything that's critical of the Democratic Party discussed on your platform. We don't want or the Republican Party, we don't want anything that's critical of this candidate discussed on your forum on Twitter. This is the real issue. And this is why I'm on 100% that we will be able to reverse this government coerced censorship. We have class action lawsuits being planned, and there's three conferences. The first conference is going to be in April 6th in New Jersey. The actual venue is being decided today, and that's called the Cornerstones of Freedom. We're going to review the evidence of censorship, the history of censorship in the morning, and in the afternoon, you know, we're going to have Brian Hooker there. We're going to have Del Bigtree. We're going to talk about censorship of media, censorship of science, and so on.
Ooh.
It's going to be great. Cool. And in the afternoon, we're going to have case law review presentations by lawyers. Okay. And the second conference is going to be 4 months later in Columbus, Ohio. And this conference is going to be called the Foundations of Freedom. And in the Foundations of Freedom, we're going to have, you know, reports on progress being made to defend First Amendment rights. This is an IPAC First Freedoms conference series. So I'm working with Kevin Berry on this. And then 4 months after that, we're going to have a day of conference out in California. And that's going to be called the Pillars of Freedom. So we're taking a very academic view, but also a patriotic view. I believe that it's every American citizen's patriotic duty to reverse government coerced censorship on social media in the same way than that it's also their duty when they learn about it to reverse government coerced censorship of media. The news from radio, television, print media, from newspapers, broadcast media, from television are all currently censored in a very grotesque manner on any number of topics by the government. And once you learn about it, you can't unlearn it. It's that kind of thing where you realize that the things that you're being told by the media in the United States, from, you know, direct-to-consumer advertising on psychotropic meds to the safety of medical devices, what they can and cannot report, to criticisms of individual doctors. I mean, really, the only time the media reports on individual doctors and the problems with individual doctors is after they've, you know, like there's a doctor in Michigan that was treating patients who didn't have cancer with chemotherapy. Okay, well, this is clearly something we can now report. There's this unspoken rule of we're not going to, you know, talk about people who have been paralyzed you know, by medical doctors who are irresponsible with their procedures and so on. So
right.
the freedom of speech will survive. And our take on this through IPAC, First Freedoms and other organizations who are involved, is that, you know, we will overturn these changes. We're 100% sure that because there's no such thing as just social media censorship. It's really everywhere. And because we will overturn this, we will overturn it for and provide and secure and these rights for our fellow American citizens for the next 100 years. I mean, we really need to show that this is something that's been going on for some time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's saddening to me because I always wanted to believe that people had other people's welfare as a priority. You know, that's the way that I live my life. And also that I've always believed that whether I agree with someone or not, I think that the other person's opinion counts and they should be able to express that, and that we should be able to have a conversation about it in a non-heated way, you know, where neither person is being harmed by that conversation or being excluded. But the more time goes on, just in the position that I'm in with writing for a newspaper, doing podcasting, blogging, you know, in print, online, also being a person with health issues, working in the mental health field, and being a mom, you know, like all of these things have really enlightened me in to the fact that there are a lot of things being censored. And it has especially hit home for me with the vaccine thing, but you're right. I mean, this is not the only issue of censorship going on. It's just like another layer of that stinky onion, you know, that it's just when it hits you personally, I think that's when you start to notice and care. And, yeah, I know it's hit a lot of other people personally too. And then just today I found out about this guy who I'm just trying to wrap my head around his message. Do you know, are you familiar with this Dr. Peter Hotez from Texas?
I am familiar. Yes, I am.
Yeah. And he's getting a lot of media attention, and I think it's okay for him to be able to express his opinions, but now his opinions are becoming so inflammatory and unfounded in any kind of research or statistics. And, you know, he's calling vaccine questioners and even parents of children who have injured children hate groups. You know, like people like me, I'm not a hater. I'm not in a hate group. I don't,
right.
You know, and
no,
I
right.
think that's just
right.
so, and he's getting so much attention and people are latching onto that. And it's a little concerning. What are your
it
thoughts?
It is concerning. Oh yeah. So it is concerning. Dr. Hotez, like every American citizen, has the right to express his views and his opinion. So we're not going to confuse any criticism of Dr. Hotez with a call for shutting him down. I mean, if he wants to say that moms who are looking out for, you know, other for the safety of other children and other families are not being altruistic, he can say that. If he doesn't recognize that as a beautiful and loving thing to do and calls for improvement of vaccine safety as a beautiful and loving thing to do, well, he's entitled to his incorrect opinion, right? So people have the right to be wrong, okay? He's
yeah.
absolutely entitled to his incorrect opinion. Where my main beef with Dr. Hotez is, well, when he goes out, and he was recently on the Joe Rogan show, for instance, when he goes out, he only tells half of the story. And for me, honesty includes being forthright. And this is the nature of this discussion on vaccine. Vaccines are effective. They save millions of lives and all this kind of, you know, information about vaccines. But then to not be forthright about the realities of vaccine risk is a form of dishonesty. And that, that it takes character. It takes bravery. And it takes a certain amount of personal and professional integrity to be forthright about difficult topics and difficult situations. He was not, Dr. Hotez was invited to the One Conversation event in Georgia, and the organizers shared with me the fact that the reason why he did not show up to debate was because he said that he was afraid of losing his job if he debated what he called anti-vaxxers.
That speaks volumes.
Right. That speaks volumes to a person's character about whether he's willing to stand up. And, you know, he may be a fine dad. He may be a fine husband. I'm sure he'd be a pleasant neighbor to talk to and wave to over the fence. But in terms of whether he's looking at it from an objective standpoint, it's very difficult because, you know, he has a financial interest in vaccines.
But he's saying that he doesn't. That's the scary thing.
I know. His byline on that is, well, I'll never make any money when my vaccine comes forward because it's for the poorest people of the. It's designed for the poorest people in South America. Well, those poorest people in South America are provided the vaccine by non-poor governments who will buy the vaccine and give them to them in clinics. It's still going to be a commercial enterprise. And so he's absolutely being misleading. He's being, you know, I don't want to call names, but he's being misleading there. And so my other objection to Dr. Hotez's communications are fairly straightforward. I think it's absolutely wrong for him to call for censorship. He's called for the banning of books, shutdown of the sale of books through Amazon and other websites that he thinks are spreading misinformation. And in reality, I mean, you know, I've read 2,000 scientific studies for my book on the environmental and genetic causes of autism. I don't know if my book is ever going to be, you know, if they're going to stop sales of my books. But if they do, and it's attributable to Peter Hotez, we've sent through public donations to IPAC, I think now 6 books to his boss, the chancellor at Baylor College of Medicine, the college that where Peter Hotez works. So that he can see that these are academic and scholarly and well-referenced books. He's received a copy of HPV Vaccine on Trial from Mary Holland and Kim Mack Rosenberg and Eileen Iorio. I don't remember the exact list of books, but these are actual, we take great care to make sure that the things that we put in these books are not just, you know, pulled off the shelf from something that somebody read on the internet or somebody posted on the internet. And so my objections to Dr. Hotez are, you know, a serious conflict of interest is driving him. He's not forthright, doesn't tell the entire truth. His call for censorship.
Do you feel that a conflict of interest is the underlying cause of the vaccine censorship that's happening right now?
Well, I think it's part of the entire engine that's driving it. You know, your car engine has a lot of moving parts. I think that conflict of interest, the profit motive, is a major, major source. I think it's the fuel that goes into the engine that drives it. And if we could divorce profit motive from the science of vaccines, then we could actually enter into an era where, you know, we could actually see approaches towards immunity. We could see the development of treatments and testing of drugs and in nutraceuticals and, you know, natural compounds for the treatment of, you know, infections like measles and mumps. You know, not only has there not been, you know, the development of safer vaccines because of vaccine injury denialism, there's also, you know, an exaggeration of the role of vaccines on the efficacy, their efficacy in a couple of ways that has to be looked at eventually, which is, and I mean by the broader scientific community, the charts that are shown that show that vaccines came in and then, you know, measles mortality reduced or measles infections were reduced, actually are misleading because they only show the right end of the curve. If you look at the entire part of the curve, it is extremely well known by people who advocate, even for real scientists who advocate for vaccines. And I'm not comparing myself to those as saying that they're real scientists or Peter Hotez saying that those are real scientists, but objective scientists who look at this entire timeline say that sanitation, you know, and improvements in healthcare, improvements in medicine, have contributed a great isolation techniques, you know, keeping kids from school if they have infections, have contributed to the majority of the reduction in the United States and to the transmission of these infectious diseases. In the future, the denialism of vaccines and autism and all of that have prevented any political pressure, have prevented any pressure from society for the improvement of vaccines. But what people don't realize is that it's also prevented meaningful approaches towards reversing vaccine injury in people who are told, no, this is nothing you can do, it's genetic, or we don't know what causes it. There's this massive influx of mysterious diseases of unknown origin, but where's the science for, you know, treating autism? Well, those are the books that they're going after. The people have figured out how to pull metals out of the brain, and people like Peter Hotez say, well, chelation is dangerous and it shouldn't be done, and it's hocus pocus. When in reality, if I worked at an aluminum foundry and I was exposed to toxic doses of aluminum, it's a valid medical procedure to do chelation. It's not black. Yeah. It's not voodoo magic. It's actual medicine. So right. There's a stigma. They use the social pressure of stigma. And then the third area that is underdeveloped, of course, are the development of new treatments targeting these viral or bacterial infections. And so once you look at the whole truth of vaccines, and you look at the whole truth, the fact that pertussis is a self-sustaining, the vaccine sustains, you know, transmission chains in the population by creating asymptomatic carriers. Mumps is the same way.
Right.
Measles is the same way.
That's a whole other can of worms.
It's actually the same can of worms. And that's my point. Once you look at the entire can of worms, so to speak, then we see, okay, this is not sustainable. So right now, in 2019, they think that they can censor us and that this somehow is going to magically stop people from becoming vaccine risk aware. And they're not going, it's not going to succeed, because every day that goes by, there's an increasing number of permanent injuries, disabilities, and death that happened in the population, creating the vaccine risk aware population. And so this is probably the fastest growing political segment, and it cuts across race. It cuts across religions. It cuts across whether you're from the north, south, east, or west. It cuts across political divisions. Vaccine injury does not discriminate. Okay. And yeah. The vaccine injury itself identifies the people who are at highest risk. And we need new medicine. We need new research that says, okay, if you're going to have vaccines and you're going to do whole population vaccines, we need to find those who are most susceptible per the 1986 Act. We need to find ways of making vaccines safer per the 1986 Act. In other words, enforce the 1986 Act. The provisions of the mandates of the 1986 Act that have been ignored need to be enforced. And that is our best direction. I mean, there's other people who have lost children terribly to vaccines, who are completely against any vaccination for anyone in the future. And they want bans. And I wish them the very best of luck with their political agenda. And feel so horrible that there are people in the population who have lost loved ones and there's no monument to them. I'm flabbergasted that there's no wall of names of those who have taken a hit for the herd. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
And that's just because they can't do it, because the vaccine, it's proof. The proof that there is a vaccine injury and risk denialist agenda is that there is no monument to those heroes who have lost loved ones for the so-called, you know, perceived benefits of vaccines.
Yeah. I mean, even an injury, you're not allowed to talk about it in society as a general and in general. And I live in a very conservative area and have not been very well accepted for talking about my vaccine injury. So, you know, I get where you're going with that. It's sad.
Well, I mean, it's one thing for you to convince them personally and say, listen, this happened to my child and I think it could happen to yours, right? So it's another thing to say, I have this petition for my congressman that says, would you help educate our congressman or senator that we need to have enforcement to the 1986 National Vaccine Childhood Injury Act. And in that conversation, it becomes less personal. Like, you know, my child was injured, I was injured, and you should know this and you should know that. Well, you're crazy, you know, this and that. But if you say there are provisions in the 1986 Act that have not been enforced, and yet they enjoy liability, they have a liability-free product, they can't be sued, and yet they haven't done the other part of it that we've been short shrifted, then, you know, I think in all 50 states, if we had, you know, 100 people go to senators and congressmen saying we need those provisions fulfilled, that there might actually be a meaningful hearing on why the 1986 Act provisions for safer vaccines or for finding those who are most susceptible have not been fulfilled. And the ask, I think, should be an independent entity, non-governmental organization, research entity that is created to conduct vaccine safety science and with the mandate of giving feedback to people who create vaccines to make them safer.
And you had mentioned ICANN and how they have a list of vaccines that have been properly tested and those that have not. And you had mentioned that there was maybe one vaccine that has been rigorously tested. You know which one that is?
I would have to look that up and get back to you. There's a whole tree. You can go to ICANDecide.org. All right.
Okay.
And if you go to ICANDecide.org, and if you go under government, then after clicking on it, you read the ICANN reply to the HHS. And in that chart, I'm pulling it up now. It looks like there was a Gardasil 9 had 306 individuals receive a saline injection after three shots of Gardasil. That's hardly a large enough randomized clinical trial for safety. So we're just being technically correct by saying that there was one. Okay, fine, there was one. But it wasn't a sufficient study. So Gardasil, being the HPV vaccine, had one use of saline. So give it a thorough read. Everybody should go to ICANDecide.org. You know, my website, the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, is ipaknowledge.org. We do science in the public interest without profit motive. That doesn't mean that I don't take payment every month for what I do, but I can't, you know, become a millionaire off of what I do because it's in the bylaws. I have a salary cap and I can't patent anything that I discover. So I'm only doing this to reduce human pain and suffering. And I think the best path forward for us to reduce human pain and suffering is the enforcement of those two provisions in the 1986 Act.
Okay. And I have another sort of aside question for you. Just I'm wanting to get your opinion or maybe your thoughts for our listeners in particular. There are a group of us parents here in Northwest Ohio that have been released from physicians' care or unable to seek medical care for our children. These are mostly pediatric or family practices because of either deciding to delay vaccines or not declining to receive them when they're offered. What do you think parents can or should do in these circumstances where we are not allowed to return to our doctor's offices or being turned away? Like we're searching maybe for a new doctor and we're being turned away over and over again. And many of us have children with special needs and with health issues that need to be addressed, but are not being seen by conventional healthcare providers because we're no longer welcome. What are your, do you have a suggestion, opinion, thoughts on that?
Well, I have a referral, actually. It was just a bill in in the House in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania House Bill 286 was just brought to my attention the other day. This is the a bill. The bill title is Providing for Informed Consent for Vaccines and for Penalties. And this bill specifically disallows any medical health care provider from dismissing parents and children from their practice over vaccine choice. I'll email that to you. And yeah, if you wanted to put that out, that link out on, you know, to your group and so on. Basically, what parents can do is to go to their legislatures and say that this is healthcare discrimination and that you want access to healthcare and that they should look, find a sponsor for a bill like this in Ohio. And the fines are, I think, $1,000 for the first violation, $5,000 for violations thereafter, and revocation of a license to practice medicine. So this is a product of the efforts of PCIC. It's a Pennsylvania Coalition for Informed Consent. Yeah. And, you know, it's worth a look at to see if you can find a sponsor and co-sponsors for this.
Yeah,
I have a bill in your own state.
I might contact the Ohio Advocates of Medical Freedom and see if there's anything that they're working on that might be similar to that. I'm not really sure, but I know that they would be interested in something like that.
Yeah, they're a great group, and Ohio Advocates for Medical Freedom could partner with them, I suppose. And you got a good, strong body of active, citizens there to follow up on. So you know how to get a hold of me. I'll send you the link. You can get your groups talking about it. That'd be great.
That would be great. Thank you for your thoughts on that. And then would you like to share again? I know you work for IPAC, which is sort of a new organization. Again, what is your website?
So, yeah, IPAC was founded in 2015, and we have, conduct research in the public interest to reduce human pain and suffering. We're a pure public charity, not-for-profit, registered in the state of Pennsylvania. We have conducted research and have peer-reviewed, scientific publications. The website is ipaknowledge.org, ipaknowledge.org, and the best way that people can support that, I know there's not a lot of resources to go around, but the ask is a small monthly donation. Even a dollar will help. So you can find the how to donate. But the website also includes preprints of papers that are forthcoming, various publications that we've put out on things like the dosing of aluminum, the lack of safety science for using hepatitis B in the in neonatal units on newborns who are underweight. There's a lot of information there, plus our more recent initiatives are listed there as well. So you can see everything. There's a list of 2019 initiatives, including fighting censorship, bringing science into the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program.
Yeah.
And the most important, I would say, is the Vaxxed Unvaxxed study. That is our response to the grassroots calls for a comparison of people who are of health outcomes and people who are vaccinated versus unvaccinated.
Yeah, let's get to the bottom of this. Why not? Let's figure out what's going on and make it better for everybody. And I just want to add that I've been on the IPAC website a few times now and have found a really great, rich resource of easy to understand information. So I want to thank you for that. I think that that's valuable to us here in Northwest Ohio and to anybody anywhere in the United States that is interested in this issue of vaccine safety and biomedical information and censorship and freedom of speech and all of that good stuff, medical freedom, to take advantage of the information that you have there on that website. It's fantastic. I applaud your efforts as well. I think that we really need people like you and your partners doing the work that you're doing for all of us, because this really affects all of us. And like you said, it doesn't discriminate. It's not just people in Pennsylvania. It's people everywhere. And this is not only a national issue, but a global issue.
Yeah, thank you. The misinformation that I see they do not come from the vaccine risk aware. The misinformation that I see comes from organizations like the AAP that sent 76 studies to the President of the United States claiming that these studies show that vaccines do not cause autism and that thimerosal are safe. Well, I evaluated all 76 from an objective standpoint, and I scored them on the basis of whether or not the knowledge claim could be supported by those studies. And that report is available on the IPAC website. The AAP is also the same organization that is calling for the elimination of non-medical vaccine exemptions. They rank that as their top priority at their most recent annual leadership forum. So the American Academy of Pediatrics is also the organization that Dr. Teresa Haltrop, who is the president of a chapter in Michigan, and she testified in a custody case in Michigan. After she was qualified as a vaccine expert by the judge, she disqualified herself by stating in her testimony, "I am not an expert in vaccines. I just checked the CDC website." We have to hold our pediatricians accountable. If we can't hold them accountable for vaccine injury, we should hold them accountable for what they know and what they do not know for vaccines. So yeah. I wish you the best of luck with your initiatives in Ohio.
And, thanks.
You know, thank you for having me on your podcast.
Right. I have one final question for you. Is science ever settled?
No, science by definition is never settled. If you take the asymptotic model of knowledge, the asymptotic model of knowledge is that we have the goal of science is to generate knowledge, not to to discover knowledge. It is not to create knowledge. There's a philosophical viewpoint that science creates knowledge as if you're creating something out of clay. It's not a manufactured thing. Like, okay, I'm working on a project and I'm building a house. The house is done. Okay. When I'm done building my house, the house is done. I've created the house. Science is actually, by virtue of the fact that we are a subjective species, we are just one species out of any number of potential millions of sentient species throughout the universe. Our approach towards understanding the universe and how it works, we have developed a systematic way of doing that called science, and we approach, every generation should be approaching knowledge with ever-increasing precision, but we never actually can say that we know anything for 100% sure. That's why when we conduct science, we often call for more research studies. That's why we say the probability that this is real is 0.001, not zero. So these are the practices of science that will prevent us from falling into what's called a positivist camp of philosophy, in which we're making knowledge claims based on things like authority, based on ritual, based on that's the way that it always has been. Okay. Instead, yeah. Science is a constant, just like democracy in the United States, it is a constant revolution. And why? Because with every generation, we develop new technology. With every generation, we develop new ways of measuring things, new ways of understanding things. And we have new people. And every new generation has new minds that think about processes and problems in a different way. And so we can gradually, asymptotically, approach, but never quite get to actually knowing anything. And so when we follow that model, then we can say science is never settled. Does that mean that we don't know anything? No, I mean, knowledge itself involves a complex mixture of the overwhelming, nature of certain types of evidence, the quality of the evidence, the amount and the degree of evidence. And that all depends on how well the studies were done, whether the right types of studies were done. In the context of vaccines, epidemiology, in my view, has proven to be the wrong kind of science to do for vaccine safety. It is wrong, and it is turning out, in my view, to be a dangerous choice to use epidemiology studies to study vaccines. It's actually putting hundreds of millions potentially in harm's way for rare adverse events that induce permanent death, disability, mortality, and harm.
All right. Well, thank you for that. That was a very detailed and interesting answer to that. And I think that when we are asking questions like that, we need to remember that it's not just a black or white yes or no answer. It's a complex thing that we need to think about and discuss. So I really appreciate you being on the podcast today and for your wealth of knowledge. And I feel like we could talk all day long, but I probably should end it here. So thank you so much again, Dr. James Lyons-Weiler.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Thrive Tribe 419 podcast. Do you know someone who could benefit from the information you just heard? Share the love by sharing this episode. Want to connect online? Check out thrivetribe419.com to leave a review or check out more episodes. You can also join the conversation by searching for Thrive Tribe 419 on Facebook or Instagram. See you next time. Keep thriving.